to bring together what we've seen so far. So we, the main points that will help us keep a context for today is that we have talked about the fact that there is a Torah prohibition, or maybe a number of Torah prohibitions, regarding basar b'chalav, and that cooking basar b'chalav is prohibited, eating cooked basar b'chalav is prohibited, benefiting from that is prohibited, and we're not sure exactly how they relate to each other. And the relationship might be influenced by Tamei HaMitzvos. We talked about a couple of different possibilities for the Tamei HaMitzvos. They range all over the map from complete chok to very connected to a certain specific reality to somewhere in the middle. And they probably affect the question of, is it really about bishul? And eating is kind of a side effect of that, which maybe is suggested by the language you find in the end of the parak of kol shetiavti l'cha harehu bal tochol, that because it's labeled a toeva, therefore it's not supposed to be eaten. And maybe that's kind of in sync with the whole theme of the earlier part of the Masechta, that an animal that wasn't shechted properly, the real issue was that it wasn't shechted properly, but once that's the problem, then it shouldn't be eaten. So here too, it really is wrong that it was cooked inappropriately, but after that's the case, it shouldn't be eaten. Or is the real issue the eating of meat and milk? And because we're so concerned about the eating of meat and milk, the Torah prohibited the cooking of meat and milk as kind of a harchaka. And we noted that that understanding specifically has been associated with the Rambam. The Kesef Mishnah explicitly says it in his understanding of the Rambam. And some understood that the Rambam really himself is saying it in Hilchos Machalos Asuros, that that's essentially his thrust. And we started to discuss yesterday the question of the whole structure of Dinim Derabanan and Dinim Daraisa, and there's a lot that's going to play out over the course of this week, but just what we want to really keep in mind for our discussions now and maybe tomorrow is there's a general assumption that Dinim Daraisa are inherent and have meaning in and of themselves, that if the Torah prohibits something, it is inherently bad. And if the Torah obligates something, it must have inherent value. While rabbinic prohibitions are generally safeguards and harchakos, and therefore when the rabbis prohibit something, it doesn't necessarily mean there's anything actually wrong with that. It's there to keep us away from something that's actually bad. It is a safeguard. And that's generally true, or that's generally understood to be true. But we started to discuss last week and yesterday, maybe it's not always true. Maybe there are exceptions on both sides of the fence. So we started to consider an exception on the Torah side of the fence, that maybe there are dinim in the Torah itself, which are also fences, which are also there really just to keep us away from something else. That the vast majority of the dinim in the Torah are there for their inherent significance. But maybe there are a handful of mitzvos that are really there because they are protecting other mitzvos. We mentioned that this was popularized, this topic was popularized by Rav Yosef Engel, who died 100 years ago. But of course, it predates him. It's a topic which was clearly discussed long before that, but he had an essay which called attention to the topic. And he listed a number of examples. And one of the items on his list was a citation of this Kesef Mishnah, that Bishul Basar B'chalav might be just such a harchaka. That really what the Torah is concerned about is eating basar b'chalav. That's the problem. But in order to keep us away from that, so we're told, don't even come close don't create basar b'chalav, that will only lead you to eating it. So better not to even create it in the first place. So this seems to be somewhat of a debate, that you have those understanding the Rambam this way, and those who might understand it the opposite way. That really the issue is bishul, and once it's inappropriately cooked, then it makes sense that you shouldn't eat it. So does it matter? Does this affect the halacha at all? To say, let's say, for example, to focus on this possibility that cooking is to protect eating. We shouldn't cook, so we shouldn't come to eat. Does that affect the halacha at all? So I think we're starting to say that you might think it really shouldn't, because even if intellectually it's an interesting point and a valuable point, because we always want to understand the Torah as precisely and as much detail as possible, so tame hamitzvos is a valuable pursuit. We want to try to understand why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do. But we usually assume that it's not up to us to incorporate that into practice. Right? That we can't decide that, oh, we're not allowed to eat chazer because it's not healthy, and nowadays it's healthy, so it's okay. And it's a dangerous path to go down. We don't allow ourselves that license in general. So normally, it's a tricky area, and the Gemara has a debate about this in Sanhedrin, whether we say Dorshin Taima Dekra or not. Are we given the license to investigate, to examine what's the reasoning for a mitzvah of the Torah, and to assign the halacha based on that? So in general, it's a very fraught area. And here, you maybe would have taken the position, okay, this is an interesting concept, it's an interesting thought, but l'maisa, it doesn't make a difference. Practically speaking, bishul basar b'chalav is prohibited no matter what. But that being said, there are a number of achronim and others who do assume that there could be halachic ramifications of this understanding. And both in the case of this particular siag and in some of the other cases of the siag d'oraisa that are on Rav Yosef Engel's list and others, you also find suggestions that it might make a difference. So let's talk about that a little bit. So how might it affect things? If you were to say that bishul is just a safeguard so that you shouldn't come to eat, can you think of any scenario where it might make a difference? Or maybe you could be more relaxed about cooking, Sam?
Maybe if you own a non-kosher restaurant business.
Okay. So if you own a non-kosher restaurant, so explain.
Well, if you're not going to eating it, you're going to be serving it.
Okay, so first of all, so you're on the way to something interesting, but I should mention some important details. That if the food is non-kosher, so for the most part, we're not dealing with basar b'chalav in general.
Okay.
Now, but I should be clear about that. So we're dealing with pig, and if you're dealing with a non-kosher animal, so it's clear we don't have a prohibition of basar b'chalav anyway. You got your own problems. But the problems are helpful because you don't have the issue of bishul anyway. When you're dealing with an animal that's kosher but is not prepared in a kosher way, you're dealing with a nevela. Let's say if you're dealing with beef that's not kosher, so then that's a big machlokas whether there's an issue of basar b'chalav or not. So that we'll talk about separately. So let's leave that out for a second. But there's another related issue that's relevant. The Stechemed discusses an interesting question. The Stechemed lived about 150 years ago. Stechemed was an Ashkenazi Rav in a Sephardi community in Russia. Actually, the way around, there was a Sephardi Rav in an Ashkenazi community in Russia. I was just to keep you on your toes. Chaim Chizkiya Medini. So he wrote a multi-volume sefer where he was very involved in researching all the minhagim that he wasn't familiar with because he was coming from a different culture. And he also explored a lot of halachic topics and he wrote about them. So it's a very, very rich collection in the Stechemin where he talks about a lot of different things. And he quotes the sefer, the Yishrei Lev, in the Stechemin, where he suggests that if you are a chef, this could be very practical for someone theoretically, if you are a chef working for a non-Jewish boss who's not going to let you eat the food and is just asking you to cook for him, so this view that the Sheikh Ahmed quotes thought based on the Rambam that you should be permitted to cook Tabasa B'chalav. That Tabasa B'chalav is connected to eating it, and if you're not going to be permitted to eat Tabasa B'chalav, you would be permitted to cook it. Now it's a big chiddush on a lot of levels, and Yossi's like, what? How could that be? Because, first of all, to give ourselves that license is a jump. Second of all, it's hard to imagine a scenario where the chef isn't even allowed to taste it to see where it's holding. So it's a pretty big jump to say that that should be a reliable kind of basis, but nonetheless, that's one considered possibility. That maybe if you're cooking for others and you're not allowed to eat it, you maybe wouldn't be subject to a prohibition of cooking. And it comes up often because, let's say, if somebody wants to go to cooking school, if they want to go to a fancy cooking school in Paris, so their big chop is they cook meat and milk. And what if you want to say, all right, I have no interest in eating meat and milk, but that's my homework. I have to cook the meat and milk. That's a part of the schoolwork. So theoretically, you have somewhat of a similar situation, although it's really less than that, because how do you know from that they're not going to let you eat it? But you can imagine scenarios where your cooking is not connected to eating. But it would be a harder jump to say that you should be licensed to be able to rely on the assumption that you're not going to be eating it. But theoretically, this is an area where it's relevant to consider where the cooking might be separated from a connection where you're interested in eating it. Can you think of any other scenarios where the relationship between eating and cooking is relevant? I'll tell you an interesting case, which is pretty unusual, you probably wouldn't think of, although maybe happened at least twice, because there's at least two discussions in the literature about this. There's a tshuva in the Dovev Meisharim. The Dovev Meisharim was written by Rav Dov Berish Wiedenfeld. It was known as the Chabina Rav. Chabina Rav was one of the very prominent personalities in Eretz Yisrael in the early days of the state in the 1950s. And he discussed a scenario, and there's a very similar scenario that Rav Schechter quotes from the Rav, that was asked to the Rav's father of Moshe Soloveitchik. So I don't know if it's possibly the same scenario that got asked twice, or the same question came up twice, because it's kind of a strange situation. But there was a chemistry lab, apparently, that developed a test to identify whether a certain substance had Basu B'chalav in it. And in order to figure out if there was basar b'chalav in the substance, they would go through this test. But the test itself constituted bishul. It involved putting it through fire. So the test itself was an act of bishul. Is it permitted to do this test? And let's say the purpose of the test is to protect yourself from basar b'chalav. If you will determine that there's basar b'chalav in this item, some kind of chocolate apparently, so then you will avoid it. So is it permissible to do this test to ascertain whether or not there is basar b'chalav in this item? What do you think? Right?
On the achilah side, I think it'd be fine because, like, you're doing it to separate yourself from the achilah.
Ah. So can you bring a proof to this?
Probably not.
Ah, well, so there is a Gemara, which was probably, I think, the last of today's Makoros, so you may or may not have gotten to it with the supplementary list, but there is a Gemara in the first parak of Pesachim, and Daf Yud Aleph, where the Gemara discusses whether we should, we have a concept of Bedikas Chametz, that before Pesach, Chazal said that you have to search for Chametz in order to make sure over the course of Pesach you won't have problems. What kind of problems? There was a discussion of Rishonim. We worried about Ba'yira, Ba'yimatzeh. Are we worried that you might come to eat the Chametz? Okay, we're trying to avoid problems of Chametz on Pesach. So there's a discussion in the Gemara. What about if it's already the time of the Isser? So then maybe we should say, no more looking for Chametz. If you find Chametz on Pesach, you have to destroy it. But maybe we should say, no more looking for Chametz, because you're asking for trouble. Now you're going to create problems for yourself. So maybe we should say, no looking for Chametz after the time of the Isser Chametz. So the Gemara responds, it records the response to that. Hu atzmo machzer achrov l'sorfo. Now why is he looking for this Chametz? He's looking for this Chametz in order to destroy it. He's on a search and destroy mission. So if the purpose is to get rid of it, so then we don't have to worry that this search will lead to eating of the Chametz. So quoting that Gemara, the Shabbat Rav, among other points, thought there was basis to say, together with the Rambam in the case of Mishnah, that if you believe that Bishul is a siag for Achila, but if the whole point is that you're trying to protect yourself from this basar b'chalav, so then we don't have to worry that this is going to cause you to eat it. So a fascinating point. And here you have just a couple of levels of thought to consider. Now you have the idea that you're allowed to insert a nafkamina into the Hisser Daraisa based on the logic, and bringing a proof from this concern of Chametz is interesting also, because you would really prefer to have a proof from some Hisser Daraisa and know that that Hisser Daraisa doesn't apply, and then transfer that over to Bishul Basar B'chalav. There's no existing Isser Daraisa to look for Chametz that we can take the logic and confidently apply it. So it is a pretty bold move. Now I'll mention one irony here. So I said that we would have thought in Dorshin time of the Krah that we don't really have the right to make applications la halacha based on our logic. So I did see one Achron who was raging against the tide here and saying that it doesn't matter whether you say it's a svar, whether you say it's a siag d'orais or not, it's still a misa d'orais and we can't make any applications. So who was that? The Chazon Nachum. The Chazon Nachum was written by Rav Nachum Wiedenfeld, who was the brother of the Dovid Mishar. So it's an irony here. This interesting nafkamina is written by the brother of the one who was saying you can't have nafkamina. So I guess theoretically, Hinema Tova Manayim, sometimes they're also arguing. So,
which one?
Sorry? Which good one? Question. If you look at the dates of the two, does it matter which one was older? Is that the. But Rav Moshe Soloveitchik also came to the same conclusion also that if you say that it's based on a siag, so then there is maybe this room to be mekel also. There's also a discussion in the Tshuvas which relates to the Shaar Ephraim and others that let's say you have, this actually comes up in Hilchos Chanukah, let's say you have candles that are made out of basar b'chal. Are you allowed to light them? But maybe if the, see, that's an interesting question also. It's also what they discuss. So is that called Hana? So we say mitzvah slav v'henes nidra. So it's not necessarily called Hana. Especially when it comes to Hanukkah candles, what do we say? Ein lana rishus. Right? We don't get Hana from Hanukkah candles. So it's not necessarily such clear cut Hana. But is it an act of bishul to set fire to a candle that's made out of basar b'chal? Or should we say that no? Now it happens to be the Hana part, you're right, is part of the discussion. But also a part of the discussion about the Hanukkah candles made out of basar b'chal is this question. Should we say that if the whole concern is achila, so clearly there's not going to be any likelihood you're going to eat these melted candles. So does that help? Now, there are a couple of other factors, you know, which are less drastic, but a couple of other details of basar b'chalav that, and there are some more drastic ones that we're going to get to, that are relevant to the possibility that achila defines the isur bishul. For example, what is the shear of bishul basar b'chalav? How much do you need to have in order to constitute a punishable violation of bishul basar b'chalav? You know, there's the Gemara, which was also on today's list, which will give you a hint. You saw the Gemara in Daf Kuf Ches. Right, how much do you need to have? So what is the shear totally? A kezias. Right, is that so obviously the proper shear? So not everything in the Torah is defined by a kezias. What is a kezias generally used for? Sorry? Food, right? And food specifically... Sorry? Well, it comes up for challah, but also specifically because food that's going to be eaten. The act of eating is defined by a kezias. So, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, we don't define bishul through a kezias. And we'll say more about that in a minute. So the fact that bishul basar b'chalav, the definition should be looked at through the shear of a kezias, maybe that also shows you something. Maybe that also shows you that we're looking at it through a focus on achila. And if that's the case, maybe again that suggests that really it's all about achila, ultimately. Maury?
Is it so partial that we can bring from the definitions of Shabbos? Then we have a
not at all so partial. Yeah. Well, so what do you want to refer to earlier in the year?
I'll look it up before I say it.
But no, that's actually something we wanted to get to now. Is it all so partial? So Let's think about that for a second. So that's a good infomercial segue. So, yes, can you really do that? So when it comes to Shabbos, Shabbos is another area where we have a prohibition of Bishul. Right? We have a prohibition of Bishul on Shabbos. We have a prohibition of Bishul on Basar B'Chalav. Do you think they should be defined in the same framework? Or should they have differences? Or might they have differences?
Well, Jassy? We first need to understand if there's anything behind the Isser of Bishul on Shabbos.
Okay, so...
If that Isser is connected to Achila, I guess. Is there an Isser? There is an Isser, right? To eat food that was cooked on Shabbos?
Well, but even if there is, it's probably not what it's about, right? So this, we actually had this sugi a little bit last semester, which may be what Maury is getting at.
This is actually Yossi that suggested that there might not, that it's hard to say, but there's a parallel as Shabbos, in terms of halacha, if it's Maisa oriented.
Okay, so let's flesh that out for a little bit. All right, that when it comes to Shabbos, yes, it's true that Shabbos we're not allowed to cook, and Basar B'Chalav we're not allowed to cook. But it's likely, especially if we follow this path that we're following now, that there's a difference between the two. Because what is Shabbos about, B'Chalav? Right, all the melachos of Shabbos, they are about our behavior. We are supposed to be at rest on Shabbos, and we're not supposed to be doing creative acts. So Shabbos is very much Maisa focused. It's very much about the question of whether you are or are not doing something. And if we are to look at an action and a result, when it comes to Shabbos, we're very focused on the action. Actions that don't have results, it's true that might not be much of an action. But we're still interested, are you doing an action or not? When it comes to Bishul Basar B'Chalav, if it is about the creation of Basar B'Chalav, so then what are we interested in? We're probably interested in the result, right? Because if the whole point is we don't want Basar B'Chalav around that we might come to eat, so then it makes sense that it's really about the result. And once you have that result, that's where there's a concern. So it might be very different. It might be that Shabbos, we're going to look at what is called an action or not. And when it comes to Basar B'Chalav, we're more going to be interested in what creates a result. So where might we find some areas to compare? Sorry?
Shchita.
How does Shchita come in?
Shchita is probably more result-oriented.
Well, maybe, but I'm saying, let's say in terms of Bishul and Shabbos and Bishul Basar B'Chalav. So, well, one area, for example, when it comes to Shabbos, there is a exemption of Shnayim Shaso, that if you have two people who do a malacha together, and it's a one-person job, it's not a two-person job, so it's artificially done together. We're not talking about two people schlepping a couch outside, but let's say two people holding a pen and writing a word. So then that's a p'tur in Hilchos Shabbos. So it could be that's the reason. That's how many understand it. that neither one is doing an action.
What, meaning like neither of them are high?
That's what it sounds like. It means at least that. Does it mean that they're not, that it's permissible? On the basic level, it means that neither is liable. There are all kinds of complications that, because we're assuming that it has to be a one-person job being done by two people. So let's say, for example, we're carrying something. So if the two people are carrying a couch outside, so then they're both chayiv because it's a two-person job. But let's say two people are carrying a feather. So then they're both patur because it's a one-person job. What if they're carrying something in between and one guy is strong and one guy is weak? So one guy could have done it by himself and one guy can't. So then it gets complicated. But keeping things relatively uncomplicated. So if you have two people doing a one-person job, so then they're both putter, at least from a liability. Does that mean it's permissible? Does that extend to other things? Is an interesting question. So the Merchatz Chinuch and others bring up the question, does this apply to Bas B'chalav? Let's say you have two people who share the task of cooking Bas B'chalav in an artificial way. Does that mitigate anything? So there are those who argue that it doesn't make a difference, that when it comes to Shabbos, we are focused on actions. So if you're not doing an action or your action is artificial or compromised, so then there might be room to distinguish. But when it comes to Bishul Basar B'chalav, all we're interested in is, are you creating this stumbling block of Basar B'chalav? If you are, so then it doesn't matter that you shared the task with somebody else. That's still a problem. Another interesting discussion to be had is, and this I'm only going to sketch broadly because it's really a sugya that we're going to get to in more detail later. So I just want to borrow from it now a little bit. But I gave you this morning to look at a little bit from Daf Kuf Ches and Midbeis. And I do want to reserve the right to get into this sugya in greater detail later. And it's a very important topic as far as practicalities of Basar B'chalav are concerned. But one area where one could compare Hilchos Shabbos and Hilchos Basar B'chalav is the question of Bishul Achar Bishul. If something is already cooked and then you cook it again, are you liable? So what's the story in the context of Shabbos? And I'll give you a hint. It's a trick question. Sorry, Sam, what you're saying? You're about to say it's a trick question? Well, because in Hilchos Shabbos, it's a little confusing because it depends whether we're talking about solid items or liquid items. So what is the actual halacha and what is the default and what is the exception? You could argue. But let's assume for a second, let's look at liquid. And let's assume that when it comes to Shabbos, Yesh Bishul Acher Bishul. When it comes to Basar B'chalav, what do you think the story should be? If it's already been cooked, is there a prohibition to cook it again? Do we say Yesh Bishul Acher Bishul or Ein Bishul Acher Bishul? You have Basar B'chalav, it's already been combined and created. Is there a prohibition to cook it again? So, like I said, this is a preview because we'll get into the sugi more. It has major practical implications. But one could argue that if the whole point of the prohibition is you shouldn't create basar v'chalav, because that's a stumbling block, that's going to lead you to the prohibited act of eating basar v'chalav, so then one can defensively say that there's no added problem with cooking again already existing basar v'chalav. So that's an interesting question. And just to give a little bit of a sense of that future discussion, so there is a whole discussion about this. There's also a discussion about various levels. So first of all, if you have meat and milk that have been combined in a way that doesn't constitute bishul min haTorah, but constitutes bishul midrabanan, so maybe there should still be a prohibition to cook it min haTorah again. Or what if the meat and milk has each been cooked separately, which would allow for tremendous leniencies? Because nowadays, for example, in America, so all our milk is cooked before, because it's all pasteurized. So should we say that that makes a difference? Remember Rabbi Sobolevsky used to tell the story that when he first applied for the Kol Elyon, I think it was $18,000 a year or something like that. So called the $54,000 question, because they asked him if you were to get a cheeseburger from McDonald's, so a violation of Basar v'chalav min haTorah, you have to thoroughly go through all the stadim. So among the stadim, like we said before, so first of all, if the meat is an avela, so is that subject to basar v'chalav? But also the question is, if the meat and the cheese are cooked separately and then cooked together, does that constitute basar v'chalav? So this is part of the question. So is there a iser of bishul acher bishul when it comes to the creation of bishul basar v'chalav? Do we say that once it's created, then there's no additional iser? In which case, presumably, you've distinguished between items that are cooked together and items that are cooked separately. Or should we not distinguish along those lines? Okay, so far so good. Okay, so these are among some of the ramifications that have been suggested as far as if we assume that bishul basar v'chalav might be a siag, so then maybe that should affect how the halacha plays out, if you're willing to go there. If you think that it's legitimate to have such ramifications, so then these are some possibilities. And what did we discuss? So just to recap, so we spoke about the possibility of if you're cooking somebody else's meat that you wouldn't be allowed to eat. If you have some kind of a test that the whole purpose of the test is to prevent you from eating or from benefiting from this basar v'chalav, should that be a permitted and justified test? If it's a candle, so you're going to melt it and you're certainly not going to come to eat it. The fact that the shear is a kizayis, which is generally associated with achila. And the comparison to Hilcha Shabbos, where we focus on amaisa, and therefore we have an exemption for Shnayim Shaso, and we have regulations concerning Bishul Acher Bishul, how does that transfer over to Bishul Basar V'chalav? All of these are interesting discussions. But now to take it into a major phase, which we'll have to continue tomorrow, and I'll give you some extra makoros because it's a very involved discussion, but we'll just, next few minutes, just try to lay it out a little bit. So the Gemara, before we get to the next Mishnah, the Gemara is going to introduce a topic which is going to build on what we spoke about yesterday when talking about Dinam Drabanan of Gezerah LeGezerah. Right, that we know that there is a principle that we generally do not have gezeros on top of gezeros. That we don't put a safeguard on top of a safeguard. So that happens to be invoked in our sugya here. And we need to try to understand a little bit the logic of that. Because that becomes relevant to our, besides the fact, again, the sugya happens to be right here in front of us. But it's also relevant just to understanding this application of Bishul Basar B'chal. Because one question we need to figure out is the following. If we assume that there's a rule, we don't have double gezeros, why is that? And whatever reason you would come up with, is that predicated on the assumption that we're dealing with a din derabanan? Why do I care? Because what if we're dealing with a gezeira daraisa? Does this concept of ein gozrin gezeira legezeira, does it apply to dinim daraisa as well? That's something we're going to have to figure out. Because that's something that's going to affect the next stage of this discussion. That if we assume that Basar B'Chalav is a Gezeira D'Oraisa, that Bishul Basar B'Chalav is a Gezeira D'Oraisa, so should we also say that on top of all of these ramifications we mentioned so far, we could also add another step and say that if there's another din that's a gezeira, we wouldn't combine that gezeira with Bishul Basar B'chal. Which would be a pretty striking statement. But you'll see when you see some of the sources tomorrow that there might be some precedent for it. And we'll have to try to understand why and how that could be. So let's just try to spend a minute or two laying the groundwork. So why would you think it should be? Why should we say in Gozrin Gzeir L'Gzeir? What's the reason for that concept?
It's too crazy. Yeah.
Too crazy, okay.
It takes too far. You never know.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? Maybe what you mean by too crazy? So explain.
Take things to extremes, it could have the opposite effect of what you actually wanted it to have.
Okay, that's actually interesting itself. It's an important point because I wasn't even going to go there, but let's mention that for a second because it's also useful background for this because there is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is useful to keep in mind. That there's a Gemara, and we'll fill this in a little bit tomorrow, but this is useful background. The Gemara says that Kamosiv Gareya, whoever adds, takes away. Right? We spoke yesterday about the balancing of the fact that Chazal make new prohibitions and new mitzvos, and yet we have an Isser in the Torah of Baal Tosef, and we're not allowed to add on to the Torah. So there is a Gemara in Sanhedrin that discusses the first parsha in the Torah, and parsha is Bereishis. So we have the story of Adam and Chava. And the Gemara learns a lesson from that story that kalamosif garei, that you're not supposed to, or you have to worry about what happens when you add on. Sometimes adding on takes away. Why? Where do you see that from the story of Adam and Chava?
Touching,
okay, right? Because the Torah describes that Adam essentially, and Chava gets the impression from Adam that, as she relates to the Nachash, that if she touches the Eitz Hadas, she's going to die. And really, what did God say? Don't eat from the Eitz Hadas. So, because that turned out to not be accurate, so the whole message unraveled. So, Kalamosif Gareya. That whoever adds on takes away. Sorry?
Isn't that only just one gezeira?
Okay, so yes, it is. Right? But the question that comes to mind is, how does that stem with the idea that we have that we're told to add, right? We spent yesterday discussing at Siyag LaTorah that we should make safeguards. It's a good idea to make safeguards. So, do you see a tension there? That on the one hand, we're told to add on to make safeguards, and here we're told that it led to disaster, original sin.
No, that's your safeguards.
Sorry?
Oh. I wouldn't know that was your safeguards.
Okay, so I would have agreed with you. I would have thought that that's, I mean, I still do. I mean, I just I'll mention that there are other approaches, but I would have agreed with you, but your other approach, we said a minute ago, is a different approach. I'll explain what I mean. I would have thought that that's the pashut answer. I would have thought that it's all about presentation. Right? That had Adam said to Chava, right? Apparently Chava must have heard this from Adam. Right? That Adam must have transmitted to her that God said, don't touch the tree. And that's where everything fell apart. So maybe it's all in presentation. That had Adam said to Chava that, listen, God said, don't eat from the tree. So between us, it's probably a very good policy we should make that we shouldn't even touch the tree, and that'll keep us away from eating from the tree. That probably would have made a lot of sense. And that would have saved the day. But because it was presented in this misleading way, that Chava got the impression that she's not even supposed to touch the tree, so therefore everything collapsed. But had it been presented in a more accurate way, that would have solved things. And that is consistent. We discussed yesterday the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim, that Baal Tosef is defined along those terms. That the rabbis can add new mitzvos as long as they're clear that they're new mitzvos. If they don't represent them as part of the Torah, then that's fine. But if they blur the distinction between what's in the Torah and what isn't, that's where we get into problems. So I would have thought that's the approach. What's interesting is that the Torah Tamima, you can take a look, I can give you this Torah Tamima to look at, but tomorrow is a short Seder. I'm going to give you a lot of things to look at on this point, so I have to try to, I'll have to try to call it Mosef Karei. I can't add too many sources to get into the Tuesday Seder. But hopefully we'll be able to see as much as possible for this. But the Torah Tamima has a different approach, and on that pasuk in Bereishis, so the Torah Tamima, I think, Meir, this is your previous point, that he basically says, too crazy, that essentially he has a much more subtle point. Like I would have said that the more straightforward answer is like he just said just now, it's all about presentation. That if you're clear about what is and what isn't, what's added and what's not, then that solves the problem. But the way the Torah Tamima writes it is that it's all about what's necessary and what's not necessary. You have to very carefully calibrate what's an appropriate addition and what isn't.
Which makes sense because we have instances where we are going to do it
zero. Oh, so that's also something that we're going to get into, God willing, tomorrow. So you have to very carefully appreciate what is an appropriate measure, what is overkill and what isn't. So it's a much more complex answer because means that you really have to have a very refined judgment. So we discuss, for example, What's one other example of a siag d'oraisa? Maybe the first example that many quote when they talk about a siag d'oraisa. I forgot whether we mentioned this or not, but probably the first thing on Rav Yosef Engel's list before about Bishul Basa B'chalav is Bal Yira Bal Yimatze. Not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. According to the Ran, and maybe many other Rishonim, according to the Ran, owning chametz on Pesach, that's an Esa D'oraisa for sure. But maybe it's there in order to protect you from the real issue, which is eating chametz on Pesach. So the Ran and others explain, well, why do you have to make such a rule? Why does the Torah have to make such a rule? If the Torah prohibits eating chazer, the Torah doesn't prohibit having chazer in your house. So how come chazer is prohibited to eat and chametz is prohibited to eat? How come in one case you're not even allowed to own it, and in the other case that's not true? At least on a Torah level. What's the difference? So there's a few differences, as Aaron explains. One is chametz is a more severe prohibition, it's Nisar Karis. But there's another element also, which is more psychological, practical. All right, what is that? It's that, yeah, yeah, see?
You're eating it all year round.
Right. Well, but that when it comes to chametz, so 51 weeks a year, you eat chametz. You're in the habit of eating it. So if you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're hungry, and you're looking for a snack, and there is a pork sandwich in your kitchen, you're not necessarily going to eat it because you've never had a pork sandwich in your life, so even at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to necessarily have it. But if it's Pesach and there's a peanut butter sandwich in your kitchen, you may have it because 51 weeks a year you're in the habit of having it. So you have to be more careful because this is something you're in the habit of doing. But then you could say, well, hold on a second, all right, so if I have to be more careful if it's normally permitted, so then maybe we should say, on Yom Kippur, I shouldn't be allowed to own any food, because all the other days of the year I can eat normally. So the same logic, if I can't own chametz for that week of the year, I shouldn't be able to own any food on Yom Kippur. So what counterbalance is that? Say, no, but on Yom Kippur, you're not eating at all. So you're not eating at all, so then you have an elevated sensitivity. We're not worried that you'll forget about that and you'll come to eat. On Pesach, it's in between. You know, you are eating, and there's food that you eat most of the time. So we're worried, okay, that's a danger zone. So he goes through, where exactly does the Eitz HaDa'as fit in? On the one hand, you don't eat from this tree at all. But on the other hand, you eat from all the other trees. So is it ripe for a gezeirah? Is it not a good area for a gezeirah? So he has the more complex approach of trying to figure out where exactly the room for a gezeirah is. So essentially, that's relevant here to this gezeirah l'gezeirah question. Right, so maybe the issue is that, like Meir is saying, it's too crazy. Or maybe it's too out of control. So maybe we just have to have very calibrated, balanced gezeirahs, and gezeirah l'gezeirah is too much. So is that predicated on it being an issur d'rabbanan? So it might be. So you have to figure it out. So there are some who say that it is, right? That essentially maybe Chazal are only creating gezeirahs in order to prevent big problems. And violating one of their averos, one of their rulings, is not necessarily a big problem. Violating Torah law, that's a big problem. violating one of their enactments is not necessarily a good problem. Or you could say that it's because there is something that is inherently different about a din d'rabbanan. We discussed yesterday that a din d'rabbanan might not have any inherent negativity to it. Right? If a din d'rabbanan is just about not rebelling against the rabbis, so then not rebelling against the rabbis is something you can only do consciously. So we mentioned yesterday the position associated with the nesivus, that if you inadvertently violate a din d'rabbanan, maybe we actually didn't get to this, I don't remember, maybe we didn't mention this yesterday, that if you inadvertently violate a din d'rabbanan, there is a position that many have, that there's no need for any kind of atonement. If you're b'shogeg, violate an iser d'oraisa, so then that's inherently bad. Let's say you eat chazer b'shogeg, so you're not punished, but there's at least something bad about that, because there's something inherently bad about the chazer, even if it wasn't intentional. But nisa d'rabbanan, the whole point is that you're not supposed to rebel against the rabbis. So if you inadvertently commit nisa d'rabbanan, you don't know that you're doing anything wrong. So then there's no rebellion. Now there's an interesting Tosis in Yevamos. So Tosis in Yevamos, it says that if there was a, we know that if a Kohen is in a house and then he finds out there's a dead body in the house, so he's got to leave right away. There's a Tosis in Yevamos that suggests that if the tumah is d'rabbanan, so then he doesn't have to run, he can walk. It's a strange kind of distinction. Right? What does that mean? How are we measuring things? So d'raisa's got to go 6 miles an hour and d'rabbanan, how do you exactly, what does running and walking have to do with anything? So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman explained that the tumah d'oraisa, the dead body, that is inherently harmful spiritually to the kohen. So he's got to leave right away. The tumah d'rabbanan, it's not inherently harmful. That is like, that is essentially, he has a prohibition to ignore the rabbi's directive. He's not allowed to rebel against what the rabbis say and to stay there. So he's got to leave. But as long as he's leaving, he's not rebelling. So it doesn't matter how fast he leaves, because as long as he's in the process of leaving, he's not rebelling against the rabbinic dictates. You could draw the comparison. It's like the difference between a fire and a fire drill. If there was a fire, so people want to leave as quickly as possible because they're afraid of getting burnt by the fire. But if there's a fire drill, so they have to leave because they have to follow the rules. But they don't really fear getting burnt, so they don't leave quickly because they just have to make sure they're obeying. So to here, if it's just about obedience, you just have to leave. You don't have to leave quickly. So it could be that when you say Oin Gozrin Gezerah LeGezerah, so some explain, the Munkach Rebbe, the Minchas Elazar, he has this explanation. He says, what's the point of a Gezerah? Why do we make a Gezerah? Why do we make a safeguard? Who are we worried about? Are we worried about somebody intentionally violating a Torah prohibition? Presumably not, because if somebody's going to intentionally violate a Torah prohibition, then they'll do it anyway. They'll do it despite the gezerah. So the gezerahs are not for people who are looking to intentionally violate something. The whole point of a gezerah is to keep somebody from inadvertently violating a prohibition. So if the whole point is we don't want you doing it inadvertently, says the Minchas Elazar, if it's a rabbinic prohibition, so then it's not going to matter anyway if it was inadvertent. So what's the point in setting up a gezeira to prevent you from doing something inadvertent? If that were to happen, it wouldn't matter anyway. So that explanation is all contingent on the assumption that we're dealing with the Isurim Darabanan. So is that the case? Is the logic of gezeira l'gezeira all about Darabanan? Or could it be extended to even if you're dealing with gezeiras d'oraisa? So that is going to impact further discussion of this bishul basa b'chol of gezeira, and we'll see, it's going to bring us back to understanding our Mishnah, which is where we all started. All right, so we will pick up with that tomorrow with some additional makoros. Who would like to volunteer to that one first? Yeah.